good to see all of you. Oh my gosh, The Course in Miracles has such a great line, and I love it, and it's true. And the line is this: the whole world belongs to you. The whole world belongs to you. And that is such good news, whether you believe it or not, doesn't make a difference. The truth is, it is true, which means whatever it is you are seeking, whatever it is you are in this room wanting, wherever it is in your life that you are thinking you are not, this whole world belongs to you. Here is how you bring that forth. And it comes from the end of a poem called Sweet Darkness by David White, who is a terrific poet. And he gives us a clue right here. He says, you must learn one thing. And when a poet, an excellent poet, says you must learn one thing, it's very helpful. Because they've written, you know, dozens and maybe hundreds of poems. And then it all comes down to one thing. You really want to know that one thing, because they've spent their whole life figuring out how things work, and it's the one thing. That's the poem you want to buy. You want to download that poem, and you want to write down that one thing, because that one thing is going to give you a clue about every other poem that they have ever written and everything they've discovered along the path. And here's what he says. You must learn one thing. You must learn one thing, he says. You must. The world was made to be free in. The world was made to be free in. Meaning, he says, give up all the other worlds except the one to which you belong. Give up all the other worlds except the one to which you belong. He says, sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn that anything or anyone that doesn't bring you alive is too small for you. Right? Don't you love that? That hush that comes, right? We're going through the little Googling the names of who those people are who might be too small for us. If they're sitting next to you, it's best that you not mention to them that they are on your list. Okay, but what he's saying is so interesting. He's saying you must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. We have got to start letting ourselves be free in this world, or we've missed the point of why we're here. Because many of us have an extraordinary list of reasons of when we'll be free. We'll be free when I have enough money. We'll be free when I'm not with my parents anymore living in their basement. We'll be free when my kids are out of school or in school or out of my basement. We have a list of when we get to be free. And what he's saying is we're free now. The world is meant to be free in right now. And if we're not free, it's because, he says, we're in other worlds other than the one to which we belong. We're beholding to a world that's not the world that we belong in, because the world that we belong in is a world where everything and everyone brings us alive. Everything and everyone brings us alive. And that's a very different world sometimes than the world we find ourselves in, because we make excuses for, well, you know, my boss doesn't make me alive, and this job doesn't make me alive, and where I live, my part of town doesn't make me alive, and the debt that I've accrued doesn't make me alive, and my ex-husband doesn't make me alive, and the way in which I was raised doesn't make me alive. We have a list of reasons, and what he's saying is start removing the things and the people from your life that don't bring you alive. And why is that important? Because the only way that we have of moving from where we are to where we want to be, wherever that is by feeling our way there, aliveness to aliveness. It's a feeling. It's a sensation that's going to happen in our body. We're going to know what the next right step is to take. the very moment we feel that aliveness in us, and it pulls us, literally, it pulls us, it invites us to take the next step and to do it. We make our way from where we are to where we want to be, from the love we have to the good love that we want to have, by moving moment to moment in aliveness. That's how important that word is, because aliveness is not just being alive. You're just alive. You're surviving. You're existing. You're okay. You're not dead yet. Your heart's still ticking. Not that kind of aliveness. The kind of aliveness that he's talking about is the kind where you feel compelled with an inner excitement or an inner urge, or an inner movement, or a compelling notion to move in a certain direction because it makes you happy. Now, the head will say, yeah, it makes you happy, but what does happiness have to do with life? It's not always about happiness, it's about duty and responsibility. And the heart will say, actually, it is about happiness, and it is about aliveness. And if you think your life isn't about those things and that's not the point, then you're listening to the wrong voice, right? Why'd we spend the first 6 weeks talking in A Way of Life That Works in this 12-week series about finding out who we are? Because if we don't know who we truly are, we cannot pursue the destiny we were born to pursue that is all about being in our total happiness, because we don't know who we are. And the person that's telling us what life is the wrong part of our nature, telling us that duty and obligation and responsibility and whatever it is we need to bear in our life is the way in which life was designed to be. And life becomes a problem to be solved rather than a joy and an adventure and an aliveness and a happiness and an excitement. See, to the ocean, there are no problems because it knows what it is, and it knows that whatever comes into its field, it can deal with to the wave. Every problem is a problem, and life becomes a matter of life and death, and everything is serious. Listen to this poem by Mary Oliver. She says, you're young, so you know everything. So you leap into the boat and you begin rowing, but listen to me. She says, listen to me, without fanfare, without embarrassment, without any doubt, I talk directly to your soul. Listen to me. Lift the oars from the water. Let your arms rest and your heart and heart's little intelligence and listen to me. There is life without love. It's not worth a bent penny or a scuffed shoe. It isn't worth the body of a dead dog 9 days unburied. When you hear a mile away and still out of sight the churn of the water as it begins to swirl and roil, fretting around the sharp rocks, when you hear that unmistakable pounding, when you feel the mist on your mouth and sense ahead the embattlement, the long falls plunging and steaming, then row, row for your life towards it. Right? She's saying, let your boat sail. Lift up your oars from where you think you're going. And let the boat, let the current begin to take you. And when you begin to sense and feel that the rapids are there, where the excitement is, where the energy is, where the passion is, where the falls are, and you can feel the mist coming up, and you can feel the power beneath you, put your oars in and let yourself row towards that place of excitement and passion. Why? Because that's who you are. Because that's what you're born to do. And we say, if only I knew where that place was, I'd go there right now. And I'm telling you, you do. We wait for an engraved invitation oftentimes to go to that certain place. I'll know it. Once I see the whole destiny written out for me, I will take that step and make that move in that direction. And it doesn't work that way. It comes in a moment of aliveness. And when you follow that moment of aliveness, when you let your boat move in towards the rapids, towards something that makes your heart beat rapidly, it's going to lead you to the next step. And we say, I'm not going to go until I know what the steps are, all of them laid out, and you don't. You're only ever going to know the next step, right? So when I didn't know what to do in my 30s, I went to a psychic. Don't we all? I mean, we go to a psychic, and you say, tell me how to live my life. Tell me what I'm supposed to do, because I give up. I don't know. Doesn't everybody do that? I figured everybody does. And so I went, and this woman channeled this spirit named Tomo, T-O-M-O. And she was wonderful. I trusted her implicitly. And this channel, you'd go, and her room was kind of darkened, and you go into the room, and she channels through this entity whose name was Tomo, and for an hour, he speaks to you about you, which, who would not like that, of course? You pay good money to have somebody focus on me. And so my question was, what is my next right step? And what Tomo, through this woman, told me was, you need to go home and you need to eat, quote unquote, some home-baked cookies. You know, and you're paying good money for this, right? You know? I wanted the name of the firm that I should put my resume into that would hire me and welcome me. He's telling me to go home and eat chocolate, eat homemade cookies, literally homemade cookies. It was like, do you not see this ass? That is not a good suggestion for somebody like me to go eat more home-baked cookies. But that's what he said to do. That was the piece of advice. And at that time, I paid $65 for that piece of advice. So I paid my money, and I went home, and it was around 9 o'clock at night. I was living in the village at the time, and I was living with a roommate. And she said, how'd it go? And I said, I have to eat home-baked cookies, right? There's a waste of $65. And she said, that sounds like a great idea. She said, let's go do it right now. So it was 9 o'clock at night. We went down the street, down Bleecker Street, across Bleecker Street to Grand Union, I think, at the time. We got all the fixings. By the time midnight arrived, I had had my first home-baked, it was a sugar cookie with sprinkles on top, my first home-baked cookie, because it occurred to me that evening, he didn't tell me to have a cookie. He said, have a home-baked cookie. And what's interesting is I had never had a home-baked cookie because my mom did not bake. Because my mom and dad were always working, and they were always so busy working. They had time to feed us, but dessert wasn't something that was my mom's thing. You got fed your main meal, but desserts never were a part of it, and the cookies and all the stuff that went with it, and the milk, and the late at night, and the cuddling, and the affection, that was not part of my home. So by the time I had that cookie, I realized there was a piece of my childhood that I was actually missing, and what he was telling me was, take a bite out of this cookie and get something you've never gotten before that until that night I didn't even know was missing, right? So I had the cookie that night, probably seven others just like it, I'm so sure, right? Because it was just me and her, so we're just going to eat the whole tray of cookies because they were good and she loved to bake. So we had the cookie. And it started to wake me up to something I did not know was missing. And that week, an interesting thing happened. A friend of mine named John came over. And John came over the house, and he said, John at the time was dying of AIDS, and he has since passed. And he said, I found a place that I really loved. Him and his friend came over for drinks, and he said, I found this place called Manhattan Center for Living. It was the place that Marianne Williamson started in Soho on the East Coast, and she also started one in L.A. as well, for people who had AIDS at the time HIV positive, but they did not understand that yet, so they called it for people with AIDS. And then she opened it up for people who are terminal in all illness. It was open then to everybody, and everything was free. And he said, "You're not going to believe it. I just came from that place." And he goes, "And I saw a magic show there. There was a guy doing magic, and I love that shit." I said, "Really? Could I go?" He goes, "Absolutely." I said, "How much was it to go?" He goes, "Oh, it's absolutely free. Everything at the Manhattan Center for Living is free." So I called up and I said, "Are you going to have the magic show?" Now, keep in mind, I'm not 18. You know, I'm a full-grown woman. "You're going to have the magic show again? Because I really want to go to the magic show." The following week, I went to see the magician doing his thing at the Manhattan Center for Living for people who were terminally ill. And when I went into that place, I felt so at home. I felt like that place just had my name on it. It was interesting because Tomo told me to have the cookie, which when I finally had it, just brought a piece of me to life that I didn't even know wasn't alive. And when I walked into the Manhattan Center for Living and realized that everything was free, that she and whoever donated their time and their money for this place, this beautiful place in Soho, it was a huge loft. Anybody who was ill could walk in and get any kind of surface they wanted, any service at all. And I remember I thought I was going for the magician, and I remember walking around thinking, "I belong here." And your head says, "Oh yeah, maybe they'll hire you. This is the place you're supposed to work," because that's the head. That's the first place it goes. How do I get from where I am to where I need to be? What's the job? Where's the money? Show me the money. That's the head. The heart says, "Where's the aliveness? Where's the aliveness?" And my heart started beating when I was in that place. For reasons unbeknownst to me, I came alive in a place that was so full of generosity and givingness and beauty. It was done so beautifully, so well, that all I could think of was that I wanted to be a part of this place. And by the time I left that afternoon, I had signed up to be a volunteer. Now, keep in mind, if you had asked me, just like anybody else, I didn't know the whole world belonged to me. All I knew was that I'd come to New York to be one thing in training and development. It didn't work out, so I was working in an area that I had no interest in. I had a job that we will call a bridge job. And what we need to understand about bridge jobs is when you are not in the place that you belong in, you're on the bridge. We think when we're in the place we don't want to be in, and we want to be somewhere else. Somewhere else is somewhere else. What we don't understand is the place where we stand is already the bridge towards that which we're heading. And we need to know that. Whether you're looking for your true love or your true work, you're already on the bridge. But I didn't know that. And how do we know that now? Because the whole world belongs to us. Which means in any direction we're going to turn, we are on the bridge headed towards that which is ours to have. And it helps us to know that. It's very helpful. So I'm standing on what I didn't know was a bridge, thinking, where is my real work? I was going to school in the seminary, but my intention in the seminary was not to be a minister. My intention was simply to study with other like-minded people. So as far as I was concerned, I was in the work I wasn't supposed to be doing. I had no idea what my true work was supposed to be. So I was on this bridge thinking, where, oh, where is my true work going to be? Right? As sometimes we do, where, oh, where is my true love going to be? And it's going to be exactly where we're standing. Because if the whole world belongs to us, and we're looking around and we don't see, we don't find what we're looking for, we need to look at what's right there. And that's one of the greatest keys of understanding this whole world that belongs to you. If you don't find what you're looking for, because what we're looking for is a door that looks exactly like we expect it to, then you have to look and see what is here, because what is here is the exact right thing for you. My path to true love and true work started by eating a home-baked cookie, right? And you would say that's just impossible. But it's what was offered to me when I went seeking it, and I chose it. I went out and said yes to it because it brought me a tiny bit of aliveness. See, that word aliveness is really key. We think the answer is going to come through our head, and it never does. It comes through the beat of our heart. When our heart starts beating, that's when we need to turn. Those are the rapids Mary Oliver is talking about, and follow that. I walked into Manhattan Center for Living not knowing that this had anything to do with true love or anything to do with true work. All I knew was I belonged there, and my heart felt so good there. And Mary Oliver says, when you feel that, row towards it. Move towards that which makes your heart beat, because there's something in it that is pulling the strings of your true self, your true identity. And we get messed up because it's not what we're looking for. It's not how it should look. It's not the person I expect them to be. It's not how I imagined it was going to be. It's not how I visioned it should happen. But it happens the way it happens, and our cue into making our way to true love or true work, and it's the same energy, same thing, is the aliveness, the rushing, the pounding you're going to feel in your heart when you think, I want to do that thing, even when everybody around you tells you that's ridiculous. Why are you going to waste your time volunteering? Why are you going to give away something? Why don't you spend that time working on more resumes? Why don't you spend that time looking for a job? Why give away something that you should be paid for? And the heart has no such discussion with you. It simply beats. So I go into the Manhattan Center for Living, and I decide I want to do something that I have never done before. I want to do something called Story Hour. And Story Hour was an idea that popped into my mind, where I bring in stories to read and home-baked cookies and ice-cold milk and stuffed animals for all of the clients who are terminal, who maybe, like myself, had never grown up in a home where they got the affection and the cuddling and the nurturing for that inner child inside of them that is now in such terror because they're dying. And wouldn't it be wonderful if every Sunday they came in and I did the room up just that way for that inner child, and I turned the lights down and I read them stories and I fed them home-baked cookies hot out of the oven, made, of course, by my roommate, not by myself, right? I'm not going to learn to bake. Clearly, I'm not a baker. That would be the end of me. You'd have to roll me in here if I knew what I was doing with a baking sheet. God, I'd never stop eating. So she baked. I got all the stuff. I came in every Sunday, and it turned out to be the workshop that was the most popular workshop at the Manhattan Center for Living. Why? Who'd I do it for? I did it for them, but I did it for me. See, the cookie started a conversation about feeding a portion of my nature that had never been fed. And I assumed if it hadn't been fed for me, it probably wasn't fed for a lot of people. And once we become adults, I mean, who takes time for that inner child that might have the need to be held or comforted? Oh, please, in New York City, you can be reading the New York Times, you can be sitting in bed reading a children's story to yourself. It's not going to happen. We're too intelligent for that. But in that room, it could happen. And that was a wonderful experience for about 6 months. Until I ran out of stories to read, because every Wednesday I would go to the library to get children's stories, and not all children's stories are appropriate. And one day I realized I had read all the stories that I could think of reading that were really good, and there were none left that I could tell. So I thought, well, then you'll just have to write one. And I had never written a children's story in my life. But I had rowed my boat toward this experience in the Manhattan Center for Living with all of these adults who were just like me. And I was compensated for it by being allowed to do it. And I cannot tell you what joy there was in going to the Manhattan Center for Living every Sunday and being permitted to do this fabulous workshop. It was so thrilling and so nourishing, and it made my heart sing. And Mary Oliver says, row towards the falls. She says, when you can feel the mist on your lips, what is she saying? There is a juice of life that happens, that you can feel when an idea takes you over, a juiciness to it. It brings you alive, and it might make no sense at all. Your head might say, this is ridiculous, and it doesn't make a difference, because we have David White who tells us, anybody who is not wishing you well, who is not helping you row towards the rapids, towards what makes your heart beat rapidly, you need to take a second look at that person. Because not everybody wishes us well. And we need to come to grips with that. Because many of us are holding on to people who don't wish us well. And they don't wish us well not because they're bad and evil people. They don't wish us well because when we move in the direction of the rapids, when the juice of life begins to hydrate us from the inside, when we touch the living waters, and what is the living waters? It's a religious way of saying when you touch the juiciness of life, those living waters are going to bring you to life. And it brings something in you to life. And it might not have any demonstrable, any quantitative value in your life whatsoever, but you know what? You're getting moist from the inside. That which was withering from lack of nourishment and water is being watered. And why don't people want us to go there? Because it means we might leave them where they are. Why? Because they don't want to go with us. And we think, if I love them enough, if I take them enough, if I help them enough, if I carry them, if I put them on my back, if I make it easy for them, if I pay them to go with me, I can get them to go with me. There are people in our lives we pay to stay where they are. And we think it's in an effort to get them to come with us, and we need to come to a place and understand it's actually an effort to keep ourselves from going where it's time for us to go. And the more people we have to carry, the more baggage we have to carry, the more we know we're not moving, not one step from where we are. And it's a great subconscious way of keeping yourself from rowing in the direction of where your heart is beating and leading you. And we need to look at that which keeps us from being alive. Anyone or anything. And it seems so harsh. And yet, what is harsh is the way in which year after year we become dried out from the inside. From lack of nourishment, of joy and happiness, of doing what it is we're here to do, what it is we love, being who it is we want to be, because others around us might not approve, or might not like it, or might not want it, or might not understand it. And we pay the price. Illness is that price. Depression is that price. Pain and accidents are that price. We think that's not a price. Absolutely, it's a price. It is a cry from our body saying, what are you waiting for? The rapids are this way. And we say, oh, as soon as I know what my whole destiny is supposed to be like, as soon as I know the whole big picture, we're never going to know the whole big picture. It's never going to happen. We're going to know one step. And that one step is going to be a feeling, and that feeling is going to be a feeling of aliveness. And that feeling of aliveness is all you're going to get. And that feeling of aliveness is going to get you to motivate, to locomote yourself in a direction, one little tiny step, so that you have an experience. And when you have that experience, something's going to happen to you. You're going to feel something. And from that feeling, you're going to have another experience that's going to feel like aliveness, and it's going to have you take another step. When had I ever written a children's book? Never. When have I ever thought about writing a children's book? Never. When had I ever considered, who wants to write a children's book? First of all, you don't even make much money unless you're J.K. Rowling's writing a children's book that is as immense as Harry Potter. Writing a children's book, the advances you get are like $300. You can't pay a mortgage with $300. So right away you cross it off the list like kindergarten teacher, children's book writer. You're not going to do it because you're not going to make much money in any of those things. That's the head. The heart said, man, write a children's book. A story for adults? I gotta do something on Sunday. I can't come in with nothing. Can't just give out stuffed animals and cookies and 99 bottles of beer on the wall. 99. You can't sing camp songs. This was story hour. There had to be a story, right? And when the idea came, had the idea come before, had I not taken the steps that led me to the idea, had I not eaten the cookie, the idea wouldn't have made any sense at all, wouldn't have interested me. But I ate the cookie, and I ended up volunteering in the center. And by the time the idea came, you're going to have to write a story or else you're not going to have a story. It was the perfect next right idea with an aliveness that turned my boat around and enabled me to move in that direction. What did it have to do with what I was supposed to do with my life? I don't know. But when we know the whole world belongs to us, when we know the whole world belongs to us, that means we're already on the bridge to where we're going. We're already there. Do you know, when Native American medicine men, healers, talk to people who are sick, they ask them this question: when was the last time you told your story? When was the last time you told your story? See, if we don't tell our story, we miss all of these defining moments, these threads, these connective threads that lead us from one place to the next. A story enables us to go back and revisit what has happened to us and find that the way in which we got from where we were to where we are these exact moments of aliveness where we woke up and we decided to follow that feeling in our heart and we can't even explain why. I wrote my first children's story and I spoke it on that Sunday. Now, this didn't mean I was going to be a children's book writer. This is going to be my new career. Now I could have workshops for people who needed to, you know, do the children's books, and I could help them, and then I could, you know, put this on my resume. Your head goes right away to the place of marketing everything, doesn't it? You can't do anything anymore without getting a business card that lists it somewhere and being on the internet telling people on your webpage you've done it. You can't just do anything anymore. And yet moments of aliveness are about doing things knowing that you're following the rapids, and the rapids spray you like a moisturizer. They moisturize you from the inside. You've begun to dip in to the healing waters of life that refresh you. And it has everything to do with your heart and your life force and the reason you're here, and nothing at the moment seemingly to do with what can you do with this? How can you make money from it? So week after week, I started writing stories every Sunday. And I was still no closer, it seemed, to what I was supposed to be doing with my life. If you know you're on a bridge, and the bridge is leading you into the whole world which belongs to you, you can rest assured, as the Bhagavad Gita promises us, that not one step is wasted. Not one step. Not one step we take is wasted. And if these steps we take are steps that we take in the direction of our aliveness, even if it means we sit home all day for no reason because there's nothing else to do but that which we want to do, and that which we want to do in the moment is paint, just paint, because it brings us such joy, then we know we are tapping in to something that we cannot see, we cannot name, we cannot explain, but something that is as true as much your identity, which is your destiny, as anything you've ever done, because our identity comes calling as aliveness in our heart. It is the roil of the water. It is the feeling you get when you do it. It is the excitement of doing it, whether anybody cares that you're doing it or not, whether anybody knows or not. And there came a day where I wrote story after story after story after story, and I thought, you know, it's such a shame to just write these stories and just speak them one time on Sunday. I wish I had another place to to kind of do some of these stories for other people, because you only do them once. It's a one-off, and I worked so hard on the story. And wouldn't it be just wonderful if there was another place to do them? And that thought made my heart sing. See, if we don't start telling our story, and I invite you this week to go find somebody you love or like or admire, somebody you have to pay maybe, somebody you trust, whoever that might be, and tell your story to them and look and see who's telling the story. Because what happens to us is not as important as why we think it happens to us. It is our explanation of why we think things happen to us that changes what happens to us. And when we start to tell our story from the point of view of what we've talked about for the last 6 weeks, from that larger self, from that oceanic point of view, from the greater self point of view, from who am I, the son of a shepherd or the son of a king? From the son of a king, the son of a shepherd is going to tell a very different story of your life than the son of a king. Because to the son of the shepherd, all of these experiences looked like me filling time. That's what it looked like. Me just doing some fun things that were just kind of interesting and, you know, kind of nice while I was waiting for something important to happen to me. The big answer to my question, which clearly was not coming yet, so I had to do something to fill up my time or else I'd be, you know, drinking. So you have to do something. That's the son of the shepherd. The son of the king sees the bridge. And it connects the dots for you. So I went to the seminary, and I asked the man who ran the seminary what he thought about the idea, if I put on in Greenwich Village a place for people like me. I'm not a professional, I'm not a professional comedian. I'm just a person who writes some stories and would like to share them because I think some of them are good. If there's anybody like me out there who's got talent but isn't necessarily an actress or a special singer or whatever, I'd like to do a cabaret one time every month down in Greenwich Village. Could he help me out by renting me his space where we had school, which was on Bank and Barrow in a beautiful townhouse in the basement? Could I rent his space? And he goes, it's so funny you say that. He said, you're the second person who's come to me asking me to do a spiritual cabaret. I said, who else would be asking you? He said, somebody in another class. He said, so let me put you together with her because she's also studying to be a minister. So we got together, Margot and I, and we decided to put on a cabaret. We started with all the people we knew who we thought were talented and entertaining enough. And we charged like 10 bucks. And we put them all together. And I brought about 12 people. She brought 12. And we decided in the future months we'd be putting out auditions in the paper. And we'd be auditioning people legitimately. But right now we'd start with who we knew. And the interesting thing was the first night, because I'm always early, I was early. Margot always late, so she was late. And the only other person who was early with me, the only other person, because Margot had the keys, the only other person who showed up was Carol. That was Margot's pick. So there we were. Hi, who are you? And who are you? And how are you? And what do you do? And what do you do? In the meantime, there we were, like, through the whole thing. A half an hour later, 45 minutes later, Margot comes with the keys. But by that point, energetically, the vibe was happening, right? Now, she gets up and she sings. I get up and I'm the MC for the evening, and I also get to do my thing that I wanted to do. I got to do a reading. And it began that evening an interesting friendship. A year later, she was still singing. And I was still doing my thing. And we began to recognize how much we had in common on the spiritual path. Right at the time when we met, she was exiting at that time on New Year's Eve, exactly 30 days before, a relationship, walking out on New Year's Eve, and you got to really want to leave when you're leaving on New Year's Eve. That has got to be one bad relationship, right? When you're walking out on New Year's Eve saying, I'm so done, I can't even spend today with you, not one more day. And she walks out and she says to life itself, I am in your hands. If you want me to be somewhere else, you put me there. I'm not looking. I need to know where you want me to be. Every one of those moments and throughout that whole spiritual cabaret, there was such an aliveness with sharing creativity with other people. There was singing, there was dancing, there was shows, we had everything. It was fabulous. But what came from it was the aliveness of another person of like mind that was there for the same reason of following the rapids, the falls, the aliveness in their life. And I would never have guessed, and this is going to be next month is 20 years. I would never have guessed at that time how to put together what I ended up being and loving, which was teaching, which is what I always was, with somebody who loved singing, where together it became so worshipful and so praiseful that when we did it, it elevated us both, and we could not wait to take other people with us in our love of what we were learning and teaching and doing in our own lives. I would never have seen how the two would have fit, nor the three churches we ended up in for the last 20 years doing what we do. It brought that aliveness. It brought you. It brings you on the bridge to good love, and it brings you on that bridge to your good work, because they're one and the same. They always are. They end up being one and the same. We think they're different. They're not. Not always in one and the same person, but one and the same energetically. So when Mary Oliver says, and look what she says this, when you hear that unmistakable pounding, and she's talking about your heart, do not wait for your head to tell you what to do next. It won't, because it doesn't know how to get you from where you are to where you belong. It isn't a straight line. And you're not going to be the same person by the time you land there. Do not follow your head. When you feel the unmistakable pounding, and that's the pounding of your heart. She's talking about the water as the Tao talks about the water, but we are talking about the pounding of the heart that says it wants to do something, whether it makes sense or not. When you feel the unmistakable pounding, when you feel the mist on your mouth, when you feel something juicy that makes your mouth water, when you feel an idea inside of you that might make no sense at all, but makes you feel inside like you're coming to life, she says, when you sense ahead the embattlement, the long falls, plunging and steaming, and it seems like this aliveness is going to lead you into something new, into something you haven't done before, into making a move, something scary, something unknown. It's always going to take you a little bit outside of your comfort zone. She says, here's what you do. Row. Row for your life towards it. Because that which you're waiting to find is already there waiting for you. And you're going to make your way towards it. A bit of aliveness after a bit of aliveness after a bit of aliveness at a time. And anyone or anything that feels that it is not bringing you this aliveness is actually now too small for you. And there comes a point, as we spoke about weeks ago, that it is time to choose what world you want to be in. The world that waits for you to live out the life you have come here to live, or the one that will be filled with excuses of why you cannot. And when we follow that world, we discover how dry life becomes, and how barren, and how hard, and how difficult, and how challenging, and how cruel. And what we discover is it's not the world that has changed. Yeah, it's us. Choose the world to which you want to belong and follow it by listening to the pounding of your heart. Enough said. Thank you. Thank you.